This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We realize that getting people hooked on a new kind of fuel is really not going to solve the problem long term. It's not going to solve the energy poverty issue, and it's not going to solve the human poverty issue.
While the earth probably won't shake the next time you turn on your gas stovetop, keep in mind it comes at a cost. This week on Sea Change Radio, we revisit a couple of discussions from our archives. First, we hear from Ole Kaven, a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey, about the connection between gas exploration in Oklahoma and earthquakes. Next, we learn about the benefits of cooking with the sun from Julie Green, the executive director of Solar Cookers International. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Ole Kaven. He's a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Ole, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maybe you can tell us what you and your colleagues have been tasked with in trying to find links between what is known as induced seismicity, man-made earthquakes from natural gas and fracking.
Yeah, so the USGS's mission is to monitor seismicity, do basic science on earthquakes in our case, and figure out what is going on in certain locales. And in the central U.S., so Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas for the most part, Colorado is part of this too, the rate of seismicity or the number of earthquakes has increased significantly since about 2010. Oklahoma now has more earthquakes larger than magnitude 3 than California has, which is completely out of the norm. They used to have 2 or 3 or so, and they're on pace this year, I think, to have about 700 earthquakes that are larger than a 3.0.
How does that compare to California?
California has, I think, roughly 300 to 400 or so per year of 3 or larger. Of course, California has a history of much larger earthquakes at the higher end, like the 1906 earthquake, Loma Prieta in 89, and so on. Oklahoma has had the biggest event being a 5.7, and most of those are between 3 and 4, some are larger than 4 still, but they don't have the very large events that we see in California.
Is there the potential for these induced seismicity events to be of the magnitude of a 1906 earthquake, Ole?
That's a really good question, and it's really difficult to answer. For one, because the historic catalog, or the seismic catalog, is not well known across Oklahoma or Texas, say. And basically, that is the recurrence of large events is much larger there than if there is such a large event than it would be in California. So making these inferences is difficult. But what is sort of the ingredient to large earthquakes is the size of the fault that slips, or the area of the fault that slips in an earthquake, the amount it slips, and then the rigidity of the rock surrounding it. In California, of course, we see very large earthquakes. In Japan and Aleutians and so on, we see even larger earthquakes because the area of a fault is much bigger. In Oklahoma and Texas across the central U.S., it's difficult to say, for one, because we haven't seen any big ones, and we don't really know where the big faults are.
What about the New Madrid earthquake of, what, 1820, something like that? That was an aberration, but that was a fairly large event that paleogeologists can go back and look at now in a new light, perhaps.
Absolutely. The New Madrid zone has seen very large events, and I believe it was the 1870s. It was felt all across the central and eastern U.S., actually, but we don't have, of course, any instrumental records of it. So there's some debate on how large it was. There certainly is a history there of historic events from the paleogeologic record. And people, of course, have known about a seismic hazard in that area. So it isn't really so much related to the induced seismicity portion that we see across, you know, Oklahoma, Texas, and so states. So it's not really affected by that. And people know the seismic hazard and stay away from that zone.
So let's dive into the science behind the fracking and natural gas, which is causing these fissures to be created and this instability to exist.
It's interesting you bring up fracking as the cause for much of the seismicity. What actually is happening is that it's the wastewater disposal. Some of it is related to fracking, but in Oklahoma, for example, only 10% of the wastewater disposed comes from fracking.
So it's not actually the injection of the water. It's after the water gets put through these fissures, then they need to put it somewhere and it gets re-injected into different chasms in the ground. Is that right?
Exactly. So with fracking, actually, the volumes of water injected are very small. What happens in fracking, long horizontal reach wells are drilled in hydrocarbon-bearing formations. Those are then fracked, meaning certain stages of the well are opened, high pressure. Water is pumped in, fractures are generated right next to the well. And so far, the largest events associated directly with fracking in the U.S. are on the order of about 3. In Canada, they're a little bit bigger, about a 4. What then happens when you produce water and the water you use to make the fractures, that water is contaminated with all sorts of stuff. So you have to dispose it somewhere. And that disposal of wastewater, not just the fracking, but a number of other oil and gas operations, happens much deeper than the actual oil and gas-bearing formations. And oftentimes that wastewater is injected right above what's called crystalline basement. It forms more or less the sort of foundation of, for example, Oklahoma, Kansas, and so on. And above it is the sedimentary pack with formations that contain oil and gas. So this injection of wastewater and massive amounts of wastewater right above this basement is really the culprit to the induced seismicity of consequence, where you feel something at the surface, damages seen to structures, homes, and so on, and injuries may happen. Luckily, so far, I don't think anybody has been killed in one of the U.S.-based induced seismic events so far. And the cause, of course, is if you have a large fault that's close to ready to break in the basement, you inject water, water pressure permeates through, for one, the injection horizons where you dispose of your wastewater, but then the faults and fractures that reach into the basement where fluid can be transmitted and, more importantly, pore pressure can be transmitted. And those then can unclamp faults in the basement that are close to failure and cause these earthquakes that are of consequence, like the Prague earthquake in Oklahoma, Youngstown in Ohio, or Guy Greenbrier in Arkansas.
And what kind of size were those 3 earthquakes that you just mentioned?
Yeah, the Prague earthquake was the most significant one. That was a 5.7, so comparable to the South Napa earthquake we had here in California about a couple of years ago. The Youngstown, Ohio event was a 4.1, and the Guy Greenbrier, I think, was a 4.0. The difference of those is that they happen much shallower than most of the events, for example, in California, and that is because you have a pressure perturbation or change in pressure, and you nucleate the earthquake much shallower than you would, for example, in California. So the effects felt at the surface are somewhat different in that you're closer to the source and you experience significant shaking right above it.
And this wastewater disposal that you're talking about, Ole, is that also the culprit to potential watershed pollution, or is that a different part of the process?
That's a different part of the process. The wastewater disposal is usually very deep, 6 to 9,000 feet or so in the case of Oklahoma. And it's insulated from the potable water resources, shallower, by a number of layers that are impermeable. So this wastewater disposal really has very little effect on the quality of drinking or potable water. What can happen, although I don't know of any cases, is that, for example, along the well itself, the well isn't cemented well, so it isn't closed to water flow up along the outside of the well, and that could potentially harm shallower aquifers.
So the seismicity events are being caused by a wastewater disposal issue, but a lot of what we've heard about the fears of methane and other chemicals seeping into the watershed and getting into people's water who live in an area where natural gas exploration is taking place. Those are different processes, correct?
Yeah, so the processes of fracking hydrocarbon-bearing formations for oil and gas production happens much shallower. The water that's coming out of that and other oil and gas operations is injected much deeper, much below where that happens, and those areas are well insulated and well away from potable water aquifers. Thousands of feet, you know, up to 5,000-6,000 feet difference between where you inject the water, wastewater, and where you then extract potable water for use.
Listen to my story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. All that is black gold, Texas tea.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Ole Kavan. He's a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Now, the oil and gas industry has been fighting environmental groups tooth and nail when it comes to defending the processes that could potentially harm people's drinking water. Has there been similar pushback from the industry when it comes to the wastewater disposal and the link with induced seismicity?
That's a really good question. Most of the folks we deal with, for example, in oil and gas industry are geophysicists, geologists as well, and they know the processes very well also. The problem we usually have is proving causality, and the problem of making an earthquake and all the ingredients that go into it are very complicated and poorly understood.
One of the holy grails of your business is to predict them, and we've gotten like a few seconds here or there, but you're still behind cattle when it comes to trying to figure out when something's going to occur, right?
Right. Well, anybody that usually claims to predict earthquakes, we more or less call a quack, and for good reason. There have been attempts to do it, and actually those were related to injection of wastewater at the Rangeley experiment in Colorado in the 60s and 70s. However, that has never been able to be, that never was able to be reproduced. So prediction is really not something that earthquake scientists do. And in fact, we think it's actually counterproductive, because even if you knew when an earthquake happened at a certain place at a certain time, you wouldn't really save people all that much. They may have the chance to evacuate or not. What we focus on is trying to understand how significant shaking and potential damage to structures can be at a certain place, and what the chances are of that shaking to take place over extended periods of times. That then allows building codes to be adjusted and buildings to be constructed in a way that they're safe in the event of an earthquake, whenever that may happen. And so we focus at the USGS mostly on those types of issues, because we feel that that actually protects lives much more effectively than predicting an earthquake at a certain time.
He's a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey, Ole Kavan. Ole, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks, Alex.
I'm joined now by the Executive Director of Solar Cookers International, Julie Green. Julie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
First, what is Solar Cookers International?
Solar Cookers International is a nonprofit, and our mission is to help people learn about solar thermal cooking technology. It's a green, sustainable cooking option that's available all over the world, and it helps improve planetary health and human health, too.
So how did Solar Cookers International get started? Give us a little history of the organization, if you can, Julie.
Sure. Solar Cookers International has been around for nearly 30 years, but the technology has been around for much longer than that. It's a proven technology. It's not something that was just thought of yesterday. There are many people, again, more than 2.6 million solar cookers out there that people are pretty pleased with. It's a great way to cook. And for women who are looking for alternatives to cooking over smoky fires, breathing that in, exposing themselves and their children to respiratory disease or burns, this is an option that they've been asking for. They say, we need a different way to cook, both for our own health, for our children's sake, and because we're using up all our forests. So Solar Cookers International initially began with a new inexpensive design of solar cooker, again, for that bottom billion people of the pyramid, and particularly focusing on refugee populations. From that time, we've grown to work with partners on every continent in 124 countries because there's so much demand for solar thermal cooking technology. What an exciting time we live in. The innovations and the evolutions in this technology have been phenomenal.
So we don't think of this often in our country, but there are billions of people who use much less clean ways to cook. Why don't you give us a snapshot of what the issue is in these developing countries?
You've absolutely targeted a really important piece, that so many people are still cooking the way that human beings have been cooking for thousands of years. And the whole issue really is about energy access. In our lifetimes, renewable energy for everyone will make the biggest contributions to human health, environmental conservation, and also political peace. That's truly not an exaggeration, because the demand for energy and our population are increasing. And because of this, we really need to find sustainable and renewable energy for this most basic human activity. After all, enough solar energy reaches the Earth in one day to power all human activity for 121 years. So this is a huge source of untapped energy. And cooking is one of the most basic human activities that requires energy. And you mentioned many people who cook with biomass, and that's true. Today, nearly 3 billion people cook with biomass fuels that they find near their homes. For example, cow dung in India, firewood in Kenya, crop waste and paper in Nepal. These are renewable energy sources, but they're being used at a much faster rate than they can be replaced. People also cook and pasteurize their water with kerosene, also called paraffin, and fossil fuels, which, as we know, are both highly polluting and non-renewable.
And they also are not helpful in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, I imagine.
Absolutely. We know, too, that the black carbon emitted by biomass is contributing to the albedo effect. So this is definitely something very important that's contributing to climate change.
And does Solar Cookers International, your organization, are you proponents of certain cooking solutions, or are you agnostic beyond the obvious solar aspect of it?
Sure. I think what you're really asking is, are we an objective source? And we absolutely are. Solar Cookers International wants women, particularly because women are, for the most part, the world's cooks. We want women to have the best possible solar cooker design that works well for them and cooks the kinds of foods that they want to cook for their families. So we are sort of the clearinghouse for all different kinds of solar thermal cookers, and we definitely support innovations in the sector. The growth in this type of technology has been phenomenal. Solar Cookers International has been around for nearly 30 years now, and the technologies in that time have really evolved. Every year, they become better, faster, more efficient cookers so that women everywhere that the sun shines literally, they can cook every day that solar energy is available with renewable solar energy.
So how do people use solar cookers? What kind of meals are they preparing, etc.?
There are three primary things. First of all, the solar cooker has to achieve a temperature that will cook the foods that the woman is hoping to cook. And the second thing is it needs to consider the size of the crowd that she's cooking for. And the best use of solar cookers means that a woman or a consumer, a user, has found the solar cooker that cooks for the number of people that she's feeding, and it also cooks the type of foods that she needs to cook. That means that I think I can make the best parallel with some devices that Americans are familiar with. For instance, if I wanted to slow cook a meat or a roast or a stew or a soup, I would probably use a slow cooker. If I wanted to bake bread, I would use my oven. And if I wanted to heat up some tea or coffee, I'd use my stovetop. And if I wanted to grill a steak or grill vegetables, I'd use my barbecue. Solar cookers also come in that wide variety of devices, and many people aren't aware of that. The most common and the first solar cookers were the slow cooker type, a panel design, which has very consistent but a lower range of temperatures. Many people aren't aware that there are now insulated box cookers that cook as your oven would cook, some of them up to 375 or 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's a very consistent baking experience. And then the solar parabolic cookers, which have gained in popularity recently, those are very similar to a barbecue grill that you would have in your backyard. You can also saute on those. The food tastes great, and it takes about the same amount of time to grill a steak on a solar parabolic cooker as it does for me to grill it on my barbecue, about 10 minutes aside for a nice thick steak.
So in terms of intermittency, are there batteries on the way that might be able to allow solar cookers to function when the sun's not shining?
Yes, there are several different organizations or manufacturers and research institutions working on the thermal heat storage problem. And I believe that a couple of them have prototypes that they're bringing to the market by as early as 2016. That means that someone can heat this solar thermal storage unit on a solar cooker and bring it indoors and cook with it at night or during rainy weather. So this has been a huge innovation and a breakthrough that the solar thermal cooking world has been waiting for. Because of course, people need to eat every day, regardless of what the weather's doing.
Sun in. Yesterday my life was filled with rain. Sun in. You smiled at me and really eased the pain. Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you. Sunny, thank you for the sunshine bouquet. Sunny, thank you for the love you've brought my way. You gave to me your all in all, and now I feel 10 feet tall. Sunny, one so true, I love you.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Julie Green. She's the Executive Director of Solar Cookers International. So Julie, can you speak towards the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves, which Hillary Clinton announced the creation of 5 years ago? What has that meant for your industry?
The Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves has stated that they're technology neutral and they're focusing on clean cooking solutions. Initially, the focus was on improved combustion stoves, which of course still use biomass. And many of these combustion stoves have reduced the amount of biomass fuels that people are using. Solar cookers were included in that mix initially, but it's such a different technology. Much of the clean cook stove combustion stoves, they're rated by measuring emissions. And of course, a solar thermal cooker is a no emission cooker. So it seems to be outside of the category.
And why don't you explain a little bit more about the effort itself? Has it kind of lit a spark, so to speak, under the investor community and the innovations within solar cooking, or not?
Yes and no. I think the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves has done a marvelous job of bringing this dilemma, the fact that we're burning up so much biomass. It's done a great job of bringing it to the attention of the world stage. And they're also working to make sure that cooking is an activity that is not going to put a woman or her family in danger. I think there are some disagreements about how best to respond to that. Lately, the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves has been promoting clean fuels, and they position LPG, which is liquefied petroleum gas, as the cleanest fuel for cooking. And that's a fossil fuel, and therefore it's not a sustainable solution.
Why are they promoting LPG stoves as the cleanest when solar stoves exist?
I believe that much of the funding for the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves comes directly or indirectly through the Shell Foundation.
So when we hear about clean energy, often the natural gas industry kind of likes to get a piece of that pie. This is maybe an example of that?
Yes, because frankly, there are still 1 billion or more people who are at the bottom of the pyramid, it's commonly called. These are people who live in extreme poverty. And right now, they're really not part of a market economy, a global market economy, because they don't have disposable income. That's definitely been a target for some businesses. They see this as a huge untapped source of potential income. For nonprofits like Solar Cookers International and others who look at global poverty and energy poverty issues, we realize that getting people hooked on a new kind of fuel is really not going to solve the problem long term. It's not going to solve the energy poverty issue, and it's not going to solve the human poverty issue.
And then some critics, Julie, think that until we've converted our own cooking methods here in the developed world to cleaner solutions, that we shouldn't ask the poor to be working with renewable cooking devices. What do you say to that?
In response to that, I can say I'm a solar cook. There are people all over the world who are solar cooking. In fact, that's one of the things that Solar Cookers International does, is we're gathering that data. And we know that now there are, you know, 2.6 million or so solar cookers that are out there in the world that people are experimenting with, making better, and using every day. The fact that, you know, we say, don't ask people to use things you wouldn't use yourself. Reality is that humans love new devices and new technologies. Remember when microwave ovens were new? You know, there were some people who thought they were magical or evil, or however, whatever their interpretation of it was, or simply something complicated that they didn't want to learn how to use. And now it's simply the way that most people cook, and people have them in their kitchens, and it's just taken for granted that this is the way we cook. And I think solar thermal cooking is actually going to be the way we cook someday. It's just going to be inevitable because of the need for us to find a way to use renewable energies for cooking.
She's the executive director of Solar Cookers International. Folks can go to solarcookers.org to find out more. Julie Green. Julie, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. What a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Oliver Nelson, Flatten Scruggs, and Bobby Hebb. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.